Welcome to Equiosity, the podcast about all things equine, with a special emphasis on the horse-human bond. My name is Alexandra Kurland. I'm the author of Modern Horse Training and many other books and DVDs about clicker training. And I'm joined by Dominique Day, one of the co-founders of Kavalia. So, Dominique, what are we going to talk about today? I think you're in charge of topics.
Okay, well, you just got back from Clicker Expo. Yes. I know it's probably a long time in your mind, but, you know, I've been hoping that you'd tell me a little bit about it, about your presentation and what caught your attention there.
Well, you're right. I do get pretty fuzzy because it's such a nonstop. You from early morning until late at night, very late at night, it's pretty much nonstop. And I do get sort of fuzzy and it all blurs into one.
What was your presentation about?
So I did two main presentations and I was on a panel. Let's start with the panel, because I thought that was really interesting. So they have, for years now, they've had a panel discussion on dealing with aggression. And they have several presenters who are specialists in the dog field in helping people navigate what to do when you have an aggressive dog. And last year, you know, it really occurred to me, you know, wait a minute. They have all these dog people on this panel on working with aggressive animals. What about horses? Horses are aggressive. It's an interesting difference in that in the dog world, you have people who specialize in aggression. And in the horse world, you just deal with aggression. You know, if you're a trainer, I don't know of people who say, well, I specialize in aggressive horses. I know there are some trainers who will go to the auctions to find the meanest, toughest, you know, most challenging, difficult horse out there so that they can show how effective their training methods are. But that's different. You know, we don't tend to specialize in aggression. You have a client who has been given the hot potato of an aggressive horse and you deal with it. And you're not doing anything, for me, at any event, I'm not doing anything different when I work with an aggressive horse. I'm just doing more. You know, so I start all horses out with protective contact. I don't start out just the ones who are biting. I start all of them out with protective contact. But, you know, the horse that's a sweetheart, that's well socialized to people, that is very polite in its manners around people, the protective contact may last a session or two. With the horses who are actively biting and showing other aggressive behavior, I want that barrier up for a very long time until they've learned how to learn and they've learned alternatives. So last year I said to Ken Ramirez, I said all this to Ken, I said, how come horses are not represented on the panel on aggression? And he said, oh, well, you're right. So this year I was invited to join the panel and I thought that was a really interesting perspective to bring to a discussion of aggressive behavior, because in a sense, we don't think about, you know, aggression as a specialization, because the way that so many horses are handled, you begin to, you know, all horses are aggressive. Think of when you have horses that are handled with aversives. How frequently biting is an issue. Mm-hmm. Kicking is an issue. When you're grooming the horse and they're dancing around biting at the air, they may not be connecting with you. It's displacement aggression, displacement behavior, but it's there. And so it's so common that we don't think about it as being out of the ordinary and something that we need to specialize in. It's just present in the species that we work with. And if you use corrections, you smack the horse when he bites and you keep smacking him because that usually doesn't prevent the biting unless you are really fierce. And so it was just, I thought it was a really interesting perspective to bring into the discussion. So I enjoyed that. Then the other two presentations.
Was there anything in that panel that was said that you felt could enrich what we do with the horses?
I don't think so. I don't think so. The things that people talked about, I don't know that there was anything that made me sit up and go, oh, we haven't thought about that. And that wasn't the direction that the conversation went. So the other two presentations that I did one on constructional training, which was really interesting and quite fun because I gave it on, when did the expo start? Friday. And so I was in the afternoon. And in the morning, they had stacked a couple of programs sort of as a general introduction to the whole weekend. So Ken Ramirez did the opening presentation. And basically, he was talking about, when do you start using or adopting a new term or a new procedure? We hear so often, you'll hear different terms being used. And at what point do you say, wow, I think that's something I'm going to weave into my own vocabulary and my training? Or do you sit back and say, I think I'll wait and see how this pans out. It's probably going to fade away in no time at all. And
do you have any example?
Well, yeah, he started with the poison cue, which he said, you know, he said began with Karen Pryor and with Karen questioning what happens, you know, in the laboratory. You can study negative reinforcement and set up your contingencies such that you really are looking just at negative reinforcement. You can do the same thing with positive reinforcement. But in the real world, there are mixed consequences. So what happens when consequences are mixed? And then Dr. Jesus Rosales-Ruiz did his study on the poison cue. And those of us in the training community really began to make use of the term. It's morphed over time, I think, but we've made use of the term. It's come to be a significant and useful addition. And so one of the things that Ken was talking about is, you know, what are some of the criteria? But don't ask me what his list was, because it's now been several weeks since the expo. And I'd have to look at my notes, and I don't have my notes in front of me. But, you know, what are the some of the characteristics that a term would have? And one of them was that it aids in teaching and it moves us along in terms of how we view training and how we train. And so the next one that he looked at was microshaping, which is a term that Kay Lawrence introduced. And I would say that microshaping really did move the needle significantly, that for the most part, people looked at the movement of major body parts. You know, you looked at a limb moving. You didn't look at a muscle contracting in an animal's chest. And I remember so clearly many years ago at one of the Clicker Expos, this was a year or two or three after Kay had introduced microshaping. And we did a wrap up at the end of the whole expo where we talked about different ways in which the expo had influenced our own training. And Ken talked about the beluga whales that he trained to blow bubbles. And this was a training project that took place at an aquarium in Japan. One of their photographers had captured a behavior that beluga whales naturally engage in, which is they blow bubbles underwater. And the bubbles that they blow, it's really quite a beautiful display. And this photographer just happened to capture a beluga whale blowing a stream of bubbles right at him. And they used the photograph on the cover of one of their marketing brochures. And so everybody who went to the aquarium wanted to see the beluga whales blowing bubbles. But beluga whales only blew bubbles now and then. And they didn't know why beluga whales blew bubbles. So it wasn't that you could say, well, if we if we throw in three mackerels, the beluga whales will blow bubbles. You know, they didn't know what was the trigger. So it was really hit or miss, but the public wanted to see beluga whales blowing bubbles. So they asked Ken to come and consult with them. And Ken did some very clever training. So one of the things that beluga whales will do is they will spit water. So they, if they come up to the surface, they will bring them, have a mouthful of water, and they will spit it at the trainer. And apparently that's something that beluga whales find quite entertaining. And so they had the beluga whales trained to spit on cue. There was a reliable cue to spit. And then they went underwater with the belugas, and Ken had an aqualung on, a respirator. And he took his respirator and he put it in the mouth of the beluga. So the beluga got a bubble of air. And then he gave the cue to spit, and the beluga spit the air bubble out.
Talk about creativity and training.
Yes. Yes. And then the belugas made the leap of, so they went up to the surface, got their own pocket of air, and came down and spit the air bubble out. But there was still a problem of getting it on cue. And that they were not having much success with, because they were clicking, they were reinforcing when they saw the bubble. But that's late. You know, that's outcome driven. So it's a bit like when we're teaching, say, a horse to push a ball, and you wait until you see the ball rolling.
It's too late.
You're late. You're not clicking the action that produces the rolling ball. And so Ken videotaped the action of the belugas blowing air bubbles, and they slowed it down and slowed it down and looked at it in great detail. And what they saw was that just before the belugas blow a bubble, that is hard to say, just before the belugas blow a bubble, they pucker their face, the melon, as it's called, but the shape of their face changes dramatically. It's like they get this indentation in their face. And then in the next instance, they produce a bubble. It happens very fast. But once the trainers knew what they were looking for, they could mark the change in the beluga's face, and they could begin to get that more reliably on cue. And now they could cue the beluga to blow a bubble. And what Ken's point in sharing this was that prior to listening to Kay talk about microshaping, he would never have thought to shape to that small a degree of muscle movement. Because that's not what he was shaping dolphins to jump up in the air and do spins and jump over poles, and that degree of refinement in criteria was not needed for the kinds of things that he was shaping. And then he got to blowing bubbles and he needed it. For me, wow, the micro shaping has always been how I shape. I didn't call it that, but it's what I was doing. So micro shaping, this looking at tiny little shifts of balance, that preceded my introduction to clicker training. So that was woven into clicker training. So microshaping was the next term. And then the next term that he looked at was loopy training, which, it's like, okay, what's
well, that
say
changed
loopy training?
Everything too. Those are all transformative words.
Yes.
Yeah, that really changed what we do. So what did he have to say about loopy training?
Well, basically, he said, you know, when he first heard the term loopy training, he sort of rolled his eyes because, you know, it sounds silly, loopy training. And then he really started to appreciate what we were talking about and how much it helped to clarify the teaching, and that it did represent a major innovation and refinement in the training. And I was very pleased. He said, and there's now been a paper written about loopy training in the scientific literature.
Right.
So Dr. Claire St. Peter and I wrote the article on loopy training. So it has now gotten a toehold in the scientific literature. And I was, you know, really appreciated that he mentioned that the article that I did with Claire. And so loopy training was one of the keepers. And then he talked about a couple that were not keepers or that were on the fence, but don't ask me what they were because I'd have to look at my notes. And I think because they were terms that I don't tend to use, they didn't have any stickiness with me.
Right. Are there some new keepers?
Well, we don't know yet. So time will tell. But yeah. I thought what his presentation did so well was it set the stage. It was a great, I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better introduction to the presentation that I was giving, because basically I was doing the same thing. I was saying, you know, in our training, we've had so many different terms thrown at us that you don't really know. Again, is this a fad? What does it mean? Is this a term that I understand? Should I be using it? Should I not use it? Is it necessary? I know when microshaping first came on the scene, Aaron Clayton, who's the president of Karen Pryor Clicker Training, just sort of rolled his eyes and said, you know, why do we need that? Isn't that just good shaping? You know, that when you're a new trainer, your training may not be very clear, it may be inconsistent, but as you become more skilled, you know, that your training becomes clearer, more consistent. Isn't that just what we're talking about in microshaping? But I think there is a much more of a distinction. And the question is, how many of these distinctions do we need to make? And I was thinking about this, actually I was writing an email this morning thinking about this, and it's like snow. There's, you know, we talk about snow, it's snowing. There's white stuff coming down out of the sky. But there are cultures in which they have many different ways of referring to snow. If you're a cross-country skier, it's not just snow. It's when you're thinking about the snow, you're thinking about what kind of wax do I need on the bottom of my skis. So you are differentiating.
Is it a wet snow? Is it a dry snow?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're making differentiations. And depending upon the culture that you're in, you may be making far more differentiations in terms of snow than those of us who live and work in cities and buildings and so on and only deal with snow at rush hour and maybe go out, you know, on the weekends cross-country skiing on the wrong kind of wax. And depending upon your life circumstances, I'm sure the men who and women who drive the snow plows have lots of names for snow. And so the question becomes, it's related to shaping. It's, do we just call everything shaping, or do we begin to differentiate? And you know, what do all of these terms do for us? So, you know, we have clicker training, and where we're training with positive reinforcement, and you think, okay, that's a great way of referring to your training. So, you know, when I think about the evolution of my training, when I first started out, I didn't call my training anything. I just, you know, I was just playing with my horses and I was watching what other people were doing. And primarily I was learning from my horses. I was seeing what worked for them, what I liked, what I was comfortable with doing. And my horses taught me a lot of the core basic principles that are the core of my training. Things such as safety always comes first. For every step in the training, there's always a smaller step that you can break your training down into. For every behavior you teach, there's an opposite behavior you must teach to keep things in balance. What would be some of the others? There's always more than one way to shape every behavior. The horses were teaching me these principles. You know, I hadn't perhaps formalized them in any clear way, but I was certainly using them, recognizing them. And when I started teaching, if I were to attach a label to my training, you know, looking back, it would have been fix my horse training, because that's what I was doing, you know, fix my problem training. So if I gave it a label, that, you know, that would be descriptive of what I was doing, fix my problem. And I was good at it. So, you know, people would learn through the grapevine that if you had a horse that was difficult loading onto a trailer, or that was, you know, spooking out on the trail and spinning out and galloping off for home, that I was a useful person to call. So I had a lot of problems that I was fixing, and the horses taught me a lot more. And one of the principal things that they taught me is that because they are so big and they are so strong and they are so powerful, and you can get so badly hurt when things go wrong, I don't need to go out with a client out on the trail to watch the horse rearing, spinning, bucking, bolting. And I particularly don't need to be sitting on the horse while he's doing that to address the problem that very often you would see just watching the horse, the way when the person went out to the paddock to get the horse, and the horse turns his back and walks away. Mm-hmm. And then the handler goes out and catches the horse up and drags him back through the fence. And then as they're leading him down the barn aisle, the barn that he has lived in every day of his life for the past how many years, there's a jacket hanging over one of the stalls, and the horse is spooking at the jacket. You know, I don't need to be 5 miles out on the trail to see what the issues are. And so we would deal with the small things that were right in our face, but we would deal with the small things. And in dealing with the small things, the big things just melted away. That often, by the time we had dealt with all of these small things, these around the barn things, the big problem just wasn't there anymore. Or if the horse was still showing the behavior, it was a milder form of it that we could handle more safely. And that was a big learning that I brought into the clicker training, that I just wasn't interested in dealing with things head on. And then I encountered clicker training, and clicker training just fit like a glove. You know, all of those principles that are really common to all good training just fit so perfectly with clicker training. And it fit with my core ethos, my underlying view of horses and how horses should be handled. It fit beautifully with that. It was just such a good fit. And so I formed this, what for me, I always thought of as this big umbrella that is clicker training. So I could so clearly envision, see this big umbrella over my head. And under this umbrella, all the different ways in which I would approach a problem fit under the clicker training umbrella. You know, certainly free shaping and targeting, that fits comfortably under the clicker training umbrella. But for many people, as soon as you bring in a lead rope, it's like, oh, no, that doesn't fit under the clicker training umbrella, because that's escalating pressure, that's using aversives. But the rope handling is not about escalating pressure. It's about going to a point of contact. It's the shaping on a point of contact. You are truly shaping at that point of contact. You are not escalating pressure. The point of contact is a source of information. It provides clues that helps the horse get to his reinforcement faster. And it very much can sit under the clicker training umbrella. So I've had that umbrella image as the organizing structure framework for the training. And then we started adding more terms. So we added in microshaping, which I've already talked about. And microshaping for me was, again, just a great fit. And what I'm really beginning to see more clearly is it's not just that we're thin slicing. but that we are beginning our training at the beginning of a movement cycle. And this, for me, I think is the real clarification around microshaping. So if we think about movement cycles, so movement cycle, we've talked about that many times in the podcast. So movement cycle is a series of behaviors that are performed one after the other. And so there's a distinct beginning and an end. And a movement cycle is complete when you're in position to repeat the behavior. So if you have an animal that comes onto a mat, say you call a dog to a mat and the dog lies down on the mat, that's not a complete movement cycle because the dog can't lie down on the mat again until he's standing up. The mat forms a really good way of thinking about movement cycles. So in a movement cycle, you're in position to repeat the behavior. And that leads us to loopy training. So loopy training is very much built around movement cycles. And we have the loopy training mantra, you know, when a loop is clean, you get to move on. And not only do you get to move on, but you should move on. And you have, you know, what does clean mean? That there are no unwanted behaviors creeping into your loop, and that you need to look at both sides of the click for a loop to be clean. All of that is part of this concept of loopy training. And then if we tie that into microshaping, what we're really saying is to find that clean loop where we want to start, we want to start with a consistent yes answer. We want to start with a behavior that we know we will get a consistent yes answer, and where there isn't a lot of other noise in the system. There isn't a lot of other unwanted behaviors going on. And so that means that we have to really tighten down the criterion. We have to tighten down the loop. So to get to that kernel of a behavior, we're making the movement cycle, the initial movement cycle, smaller and smaller and smaller. We're shrinking it down. And we're shrinking it down so that where we may be beginning is just in that initial, I'm initiating into the movement. I haven't taken a step yet. I have, maybe all I've done is taking a breath, or there's a tiny weight shift. It's a tiny, tiny movement. And I'm going to click on that. And then I'm going to go back through the food delivery. I'm going to go back to the beginning of that movement cycle. So in microshaping, we're shrinking the initial movement cycle, the initial loop, down to a very small kernel of a behavior. And that to me is microshaping. And then through the loopy training, we're expanding out into more complex behaviors. So loopy training gives us the structure for expanding beyond that simple tiny little weight shift, because if you could never get beyond that tiny little weight shift, it would be meaningless. So the microshaping becomes tied in to the loopy training, and all of that takes us to an errorless learning type of approach and mindset, which takes us to constructional training.
And so that part of it is words, the constructional training or approach. Is that Ken's words?
No, he did not. He did not talk about constructional training. So I would say that
for me, that word made a difference in my training.
In what way?
Well, since I've heard about this, I much more look at building skills, required skills.
Yes.
Much more than before. I also work more in a setting that may be completely different from the end behavior I'm looking for.
Okay.
So I'm constructing more.
Yes. Yes.
I'm less, because I've heard constructional training or constructional approach, I am less outcome oriented. Yeah. And I think it's my go-to. I don't It's not even if it's not going well, I will think about the constructional approach. It's where I start from the very beginning, even if this is going to be an easy thing. That's how now my brain sets up
a
training session. Before, I would have been much closer to the end behavior. I would have lumped more because of that. So I've known about the thin slicing all the time.
Right, absolutely.
Somehow the building of repertoire, the building of skills that is put forth when you talk about the constructional approach has made me a better thin slicer.
Yes, yes, I would agree. And I would say that, you know, in terms of new words that are coming down the pike, that constructional training for me has stickiness. You know, obviously.
Even, you know, I know that the clicker training train has left the station a long time ago, but I find the constructional training less reductive than the clicker training, you know, because when you say what I do in life is marker training, you know, the click is so, I mean, such a little part of it.
Yes.
Whereas I find constructional training encompasses more. And you could be a constructional trainer and use negative reinforcement.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, we know it's actually one of the trademark of good trainers is that whether they're positive or negative, traditional or more modern, whatever we want to call them, but they are all very much constructional. They know how to build skills before asking for something that requires that skill.
Yeah.
But clicker training in a way doesn't mean positive reinforcement either. When you look at the actual word, it's just marker training.
Right. And it does not preclude. So when I say I am a clicker trainer, that gives you a certain amount of information. It tells you that I use a marker signal, I pair it with positive reinforcement. But that's not I could use a marker signal. And when my animal does something that I like, I might click and reinforce. But when he doesn't respond fast enough, there's nothing in that basic definition that says that I'm not going to punish my animal because he didn't respond fast enough.
No, and you could actually also use a marker for telling them they're doing it wrong, which we've been discouraged to do.
Right. So you could be
a marker trainer and have a click for the positive and something for the negative.
Right.
Indicate to the animal he doesn't have it.
Right.
That would be marker training too.
There are many versions of positive reinforcement. There are many ways in which positive reinforcement and marker signals can be used. So to say simply that I use a marker signal and positive reinforcement is not a complete picture. So, you know, we have to begin to add more details to that. And one of those details that I think is very clarifying is to say that I am a constructional trainer. But again, that's, you know, we always have to define what we mean by that. So I'm sort of staking out a claim, as it were. It's like going to a gold field, you know, where in the old days going up into the Yukon and up into the areas where gold was discovered. And I'm staking out a claim. I'm saying this little piece of this territory, this is my area to go dig down and find the gems that are hidden here, find the gold gems that are hidden here. And I suspect that people will end up using constructional training to mean many, many, many different things. And who knows, down the road, I may decide, oh, I wish I hadn't used constructional training because people have done weird things with it. And it's come to mean something other that I'm not liking. But for now, I think it's a very clear term. And I guess
we didn't want to use as a community a negative label like force-free training or...
Well, that's out there and people do use it. But we won't go down that road. I like to construct things. So I like to build things. I loved the process of when we built the barn. You know, I loved that sort of thing. And yeah, I love building books, constructing books. So constructional training to me is another term that just fits comfortably with for me. And it makes sense, this idea of that we are going to be building skills. And again, if I, you know, when I look at the training and I look at what I've been teaching all these years, and I keep saying everything is connected to everything else, I've been trying to get that across. And I think constructional training adds clarity. You know, when you say you're training better because you're really recognizing that there are component skills, you know, and I think before, often we had put those component skills in repertoire and they were working for us, but we weren't necessarily recognizing how much easier the training was going because we taught those horses those skills. And when you, for example, if you're somebody who only has one or two horses and you're not working with lots of other horses, so you're not encountering, you know, I brought the horse up to the horse trailer and he wouldn't load. Well, he doesn't know how to go up onto platforms. He doesn't know how to go underneath things. He does all these things that this horse doesn't know how to do. And you're saying, go on to the trailer, horse. And the horse is saying, no, not going to do it. You may not appreciate how much easier your job would be if he had all of those skills, because your own personal horse happens to have those skills in place and is comfortable going up on the horse trailer. So you may not recognize that you are the beneficiary of a constructional approach. You're just not being really deliberate in it. And so I think the game changer and the reason that it is a useful addition to our training vocabulary is that it helps to make us more deliberate. That's why I've taken it on so strongly. And it sits at the core of the new book, Modern Horse Training, where I really, you know, what I'm talking about is what I'm covering here in this discussion. And so for me, what has changed is the way that I visualize, you know, when I'm thinking about that sort of graphic illustration of the training, I think of constructional training like a tent that is supported by four posts. And those four posts are the four questions that Dr. Gold Diamond recommends that we ask. You know, where are you? What are your goals? Where are you now? What is in repertoire? How are you going to get from where you are now to where you want to go, and what will keep you motivated? So you have those four tent posts supporting the tent of constructional training. And underneath that tent, clicker training sits beautifully, comfortably. And it sits on an underpinning of core ethics. So I, you know, it's how I layer things in my thinking. And so when I'm looking at a new horse handler team, or I'm looking at training behavior that I haven't taught to my own horses, or I'm dealing with a problem that has cropped up, I approach it from that constructional, let's look at those four questions. That will take me, when you get to that question, how are you going to teach it? Well, I'm going to be using clicker training and all that involves. And under the clicker training umbrella will sit the loopy training and all that means, and the micro shaping and all that means. And so it was defining, giving more meaning to a lot of these terms that have just been sort of bandied about recently. When I listen to other presentations and I hear lots of references to loopy training, and I just wonder, you know, are we using the term, but assuming that people understand what we're talking about, but we no longer know what we're talking about, you know, and all of these terms. So we've used micro shaping. Is it still relevant? Are we still using it? Do we want to use it? We use loopy training. Is it still relevant? Where do all of these terms sit? Does micro shaping replace shaping? No, I don't think it does. Does loopy training replace clicker training? Absolutely not. You know, loopy training is a teaching strategy. For me, clicker training is that larger umbrella under which loopy training sits. So, you know, it's how do we put all of these puzzle pieces together so that we come out with a coherent way of thinking about our training and talking about our training. So that was that presentation. Yeah, and I ended with some practical, you know, here's some practical examples of how all of this works. So here's some things that you could take home and play around with your own horses to gain some experience with this. So it wasn't all theoretical. It was also a lot of practical as well. So that was that presentation. And then the other presentation was on balance. We'll leave the presentation on balance for next week. I loved the Clicker Expo. It was enormous fun. The presentations were great. The company was great. It was wonderful to be back with other clicker trainers again. It was a wonderful, wonderful weekend. The one drawback was that Monday, April 8th, was the day that we had a full solar eclipse that could be seen on the East Coast. But because I was out in Portland, Oregon, I missed it. But Dominique didn't. The full solar eclipse was visible in her area. And so before we started recording the podcast, she shared with me what an eclipse, what that experience was like. So for all of you who missed out on the eclipse, here's her description of that event.
Oh, Alex, I shouldn't be telling you this because I know you only saw part of it, but my God, it was so, so magical. And the difference between a 99.9 eclipse and a 100% eclipse, that is where the magic happens. Because, I mean, it's fun to see, you know, the croissant.
Yeah.
But we kind of see that with the moon a lot. You know, we see a little quarter of a moon and half a moon and a full moon. But when it's total, the light, it's not dark. It's different from dark. It's like a light from another world. It is so magical, the light. I had a sunset at the same time, but not where the sunset usually is, because the sunset is usually west.
Right.
But I had a sunset at the north of my property, because the sun was right there. So I don't know. It was also, we had, and I could hear the kids at the school is not very far from my house.
Yeah.
And obviously it was one of the schools that did a project around the eclipse, because there was a big controversy here, because some of the school decided that it was too dangerous and that they were going to give everyone a holiday. In other words, you know, let the parents handle it. Yes. Which was crazy. I mean, it was very criticized because it's a once in a lifetime event. It's a great science project.
Yes.
And it shouldn't be missed. Anyway, we could hear this, the and, children.
And what are the schools for if not to educate?
I know. And, you know, come on. But is it because they really can't manage kids anymore and ask them to keep glasses on? You know, because all there is to it, just keep your glass on, you know. Anyway, but we had decided that we weren't going to talk to, because here the total eclipse, I was in the place where the eclipse was the longest.
Oh, neat.
Okay, so we were like really privileged. In Montreal, the eclipse was a minute. Us, it was 3 minutes.
Wow.
So it was the top. And we had said, we're not going to scream. We're going to be in silence.
Yeah.
When the eclipse arrived, we want to take it in. We're not going to be crazy people trying to take photos and getting, you know, we'll really take it in. We couldn't completely not say anything because it was so gorgeous and strange and different, but we were pretty good at it. And from afar, we could hear the kids, which was kind of fun too, because they were very excited. But it was a very bonding experience. I mean, these were old friends, you know, really, really old friends, people I've known for 40 years. And there was a price for them to get to my place because the traffic jam was amazing in the province. It was like crazy. It was a work day, but people really wanted to, and it was perfectly sunny. There was one cloud. So it was so amazing. And so, yeah, people were caught in the traffic. Like one of the couples, they came from, usually it's a 2-hour drive. It took them 4 hours to get to my, they arrived just as the eclipse was starting. So people here really, really, I mean, there was this traffic, how do you say in English? Like radio chroniker? No, that's not the word.
Well,
radio,
traffic reports.
Someone who the traffic. Reporter, yeah. And he's been doing traffic for more than 15 years. And he said he had never seen that. So much traffic, like everywhere. Because usually there's traffic in Montreal. There might be a little bit of traffic when it's apple time, because on the top shore there are lots of apple trees. But like that, never. And nothing happened. You know, there was no rage at the wheel, or people were like, in a celebratory mood. And so it was wonderful. I will cherish that for the rest of my life. It was really great. Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm so sorry you missed it. I'm really
I
sorry.
I am too. But,
yeah.
But I would have missed, because I would not have driven far enough north to be in the totality. I wouldn't.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm guessing I would not have. I probably would not have recognized that there was that much difference.
Oh, there is. And you know what's strange too, is that at 99, and we had this, one of my friends had an app on his phone that said, you know, how many percentage of the eclipse was going on, how many degrees we had lost, like, because you lose 5 degrees, you know, you can feel a little bit of difference in the temperature. And when we can take the glasses off, when it's total, and when we have to put them back on because the total is over. And so it was 99%. And it was still a sunny day. There was almost no difference in the light because there was still enough of it at 99% to lighten the whole place. But at 100, oof. All of a sudden, it's that, like I said, it's not really darkness. It's not like black pitch darkness. It's much more beautiful than that. It's dark, but it's like a kind of, it's hard. It's like dark, but in a kind of light and envelope a little bit. So it's, wow, it was really, and it's difficult to photograph. You know, we did take just a few, but we knew that we didn't want to spend the 3 minutes looking, did I do well? Do I need a filter?
Right.
We didn't want to do that. So we just took one of the eclipses, and it looks like the sun, and one of the ambient light, and that was a little bit better, but not, it's not like when you live it. So I mean, it's a privilege. I know that in Texas, they had some clouds and, you know, I've read of the eclipse in, I think it was in the 80s in Hawaii, where it was super cloudy just at the wrong time.
Yeah.
So we were really blessed to to be able to see it like that in full sun was great. And the weather was beautiful. It was like 15, well, I don't know, in Fahrenheit, maybe, I don't know.
A nice mild day.
Yeah, yeah. we were well prepared, and so it was a great party. Yeah.
Neat.
So now we know. The next time there's a full solar eclipse, it is very much worth making the effort to experience it. So next time, we'll talk about my Clicker Expo program on balance. And until then, train well and have fun with your horses.